Hi, I'm Catherine Gunn, and I was the GCHQ whistleblower who blew the whistle about the before the run-up to the Iraq War. So how are you today, Tony?
Yeah, I'm fine. Now you're doing this regular, well, I suppose it's like a kind of column really with us, which is absolutely brilliant, Catherine. And every week you're coming up with something which is enlightening, which I suppose we should be paying more and more attention to this because there's been an announcement this week that the 12 biggest mass media owners companies in Britain are going to be pushing climate change even more. It does sound to me as if the journalists are being compromised by their managers and editors again, where they're being told what to write about, that balance is going to be further taken away from the press coverage that we get, and that we're just going to simply be following this climate change gravy train. And I think it is a gravy train because there is finance going to many of these media companies from people like the Gates Foundation, and the journalists that start to, and scientists even, very, very eminent scientists, including people on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change from the UN, if they don't chime in with this agenda, then they are forced to resign by one means or another. But anyway, I mean, what I suppose I'm saying is that we've got increasing kind of propagandization of the mass media. So we need to hear various little bits of alternative media. In this case, I know today you want to talk about the BBC and why you think it may have been steered away from having balanced reporting on the pharmaceutical industry.
Yes, well, going back, your point about the largest mass media. I mean, we know that basically most of the media organizations are controlled by about six major groups. And there was an example just the other day when in New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern was being questioned and interviewed openly at a, in a open area outside a building. And there were some alternative media journalists who were trying to speak and ask questions, but there was a group of, mainstream journalists, and Jacinda actually said, apologized to the mainstream journalists and said, "Look, we have, I'm only taking questions from accredited media." And that phrase, accredited media, is something that I think is going to keep coming up now. Is that And they're trying, and they've been, I've seen this covered before, where they keep trying to instill in the children at school when they're looking for information and seeking knowledge about stuff, is to only look at websites that are accredited, that have, the authority's stamp of approval. And so this is the attempt to squash this democratic flowering of, the World Wide Web and the access to a whole variety, a myriad of information that allows us to come to our own conclusions about what we think chimes true.
Right. Well,
And
accredited media, that's a phrase I first heard put out by the police. Now, that was really what happened was various news outlets, including people like ITV, for example, in the southwest of England, lost their accreditation from going to, in, so, so they would ne not be allowed in and they would not be invited to police press conferences if they reported unfavorably on the police. So, for example, a criticism of the chief constable would mean that you would, for several months or maybe even years, lose accreditation. So that's really is what's happening here, I think, is just a slow alteration from public bodies or bodies that should be public, paid for and accountable bodies, taking on the tactics of people like BP and Shell, and you know, the big massive, you know, transnational corporations who do very carefully select and choose who, which media they will talk to and which they won't.
Yeah, managing the process and the flow of information. So this week I stumbled upon a documentary that I hadn't ever seen before, and I was quite astonished that it had come from the BBC. And it was their series, a BBC Two series called This World. And the documentary was called Guinea Pig Kids. And basically, this is what it says on the BBC's own website. It says, vulnerable children in some of New York's poorest districts are being forced to take part in HIV drug trials. During a nine-month investigation, the BBC has uncovered the disturbing truth about the way authorities in New York City are conducting the fight against AIDS. HIV-positive children, some only a few months old, are enrolled in toxic experiments without the consent of guardians or relatives. In some cases where parents have refused to give children their medication, they have been placed in care. The city's Administration of Children's Services, ACS, does not even require court order to place HIV kids with foster parents or in children's homes, where they can continue to give them experimental drugs. Reporter Jamie Doran talks to parents and guardians who fear for the lives of their loved ones, and to a child who spent years on a drugs program that made him and his friends ill. And the actual show goes on to say that some 200 children died with these experimental drug programs. And the BBC was even attacked by the big drugs companies for being AIDS denialists and so on. But, you know, this program came out, it came out actually at the end of 2004. And then when I had a quick look, because I knew that, you know, the Gates Foundation has given grant funding to the BBC, Media Action Group, and to The Guardian. Now, looking online and having a bit of a dig around, I found a link. And although the actual link says current data is preliminary and has not been completely vetted and normalized, please include the caveat that the data is preliminary if you want to share. So, looking at the actual donations, this link provides information about the donations that were given to BBC Media Action Group. And the donations began in 2006. In 2006, they were granted over $6.5 million from the Gates Foundation. And that dropped in 2009 to a measly $700,000. But then in 2010, it jumped massively to $20 million. So reports, you know, you can find reports online about the $20 million donation by the Gates Foundation to BBC Media Action. It doesn't mention the first amount, though, that was in 2006. And this link actually breaks down what those donations were specifically for. So in 2006, the donation was made, payment was made in September of 2006, and it was specifically for global health STD control, including HIV/AIDS. And, you know, the actual description of what that 6 million was specifically for, it says here to prevent HIV/AIDS transmission in high prevalence districts of 4 Indian states by using mass media to promote condom use. So 6 million, 6.392 million for media action promoting condom use. That sounds like an eye-watering amount of money for such a simple type of activity, doesn't it? And then the large sum of money in 2010, which totaled eventually to some 20 million. Was all about, principally, the descriptions are about shaping demand and social norms and improve family health practice in a state in India, a state called Bihar. And that's what all of this money, 20 million, to promote family planning and to shape societal norms, social norms, and demand. You know, there's no kind of real, it's all very vague, isn't it? It's all very unspecific and vague. And the province of Bihar in India, I've learned, is one of the poorest areas of India, which borders Nepal. So it's, you know, it's kind of interesting that from 2006 onwards, BBC Media Action, which is supposed to be a sort of charitable arm of the BBC and allegedly doesn't you know, have anything to do with reporting necessarily, I think. But in total, it looks like they have received, in total, from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, $45 million to date, to 2017, actually, this is. And, you know, so from that point onward, from about, you know, 2010 onwards, it seems, you know, the BBC has almost been neutered in a way, and in terms of having any teeth in digging into and really, you know, investigating these big pharma connections and health policies and so on. I mean, I think this is possibly fairly well known, but there was another, and by the way, the Guinea Pig Kids documentary, it's only about 40 minutes long. You can find it online by searching for Guinea Pig Kids. It's an absolutely devastating documentary. And there was another documentary which was part of Channel 4 News, which was presented by Jon Snow back in 2009, which again was looking into the swine flu false pandemic, featuring your favorite doctor of the week at one point, Dr. Wolfgang Wodarg, you know, explaining how it was completely a pharma-driven narrative, and that the vaccine purchases made by national governments many of them had to be binned, or some of them were perhaps even, you know, forwarded on, shipped on to poorer countries in a sort of altruistic, quote unquote, move. But because they actually caused thousands of children in Europe to develop narcolepsy, which has lifelong implications and basically, you know, prevents them from leading a normal life. So you know, it's very, you know, when you see that Channel 4 News investigation into the 2009 fake pandemic, that isn't being repeated again, is it? It's carrying on. You know, they continue to spew the narrative about COVID and this so-called pandemic, which, you know, as the Canadian researchers have suggested, it isn't itself a pandemic. There's no real evidence apart from this rolling tab of mortality that's being attributed to COVID. You know, there's no real evidence of a pandemic. So, yeah, my question is, how can we trust these so-called accredited media if they are receiving millions of pounds and dollars from, you know, these so-called philanthropic foundations and funds where there's a direct conflict of interest? Because Bill Gates also funds Gavi and the World Health Organization and CEPI and various other groups that are funding vaccines research and vaccine marketing and production. So, you know, there's a huge, and I think a lot of people are aware of this, but, you know, it really makes you question how we can possibly trust the media, the mainstream media, and so-called accredited news organizations and media, when this is how the system works.
Yeah, I think just looking at some of that funding to actually run, you know, say if you and I were to decide to start a full-time radio station, which was, you know, like Radio 4 or something, the cost of that, you know, to employ roughly, what, 40 people full-time would be about $1 million a year. So, you know, what the Gates Foundation is really doing is, you know, over, it's actually funding the entire, what could is the equivalent of an entire radio channel full of people. And yet you're saying that this is going towards just one program to do with AIDS in India, which I find quite difficult to believe. But anyway, yeah, so, I mean, this is just the BBC. I suppose that wouldn't be true for all of the other mainstream media outlets like Sky, though, Catherine.
Well, yes, I don't know whether the Gates Foundation also funds Sky, but, you know, there are ways to, you know, find these things out, and there are roundabout ways for these foundations to support various organizations. And
but and also, of course, media. Those other forms of media are commercial media, so, you know, they can be bribed, basically, by advertisers, etc., and by other means.
Yeah, that's true. So, I mean, I think that there's been a TED talk, that quite a famous TED talk by Bill Gates. Now, I can't remember exactly if it was 2015 or 2017, where he, you know, he famously said or made a statement, something like, you know, if we do a really great job on vaccines, on family planning and on education, we can possibly reduce or probably reduce the world population by, you know, 10 to 15%. Do you remember that quote by Bill Gates at a TED talk? And, you know, people have taken that maybe out of context and said, look, you know, he's using vaccines to reduce population. This is, you know, he's telling us openly that this is what he's doing. And so I started thinking about, you know, population reduction and why are they talking about population reduction? Because, you know, clearly they seem to think that the world is, you know, the population is growing. And this is part of the, you know, climate change narrative and how, wow, we're going to have increasingly more and more people, probably, possibly peaking at 11 billion at the end of the century. And so, you know, we've got to do everything in our power to reduce our carbon consumption and so on. But when you start digging a little bit more and you start looking at various other scientific papers and other people who are thinking along these lines, the reality might be the opposite, that in fact, the population isn't growing. It's actually declining across all the major nations. So the average number of births you need in any country to maintain a stable number, maintain the population, is 2.1, right? The famous, you know, 2.1 children. And, you know, across most of the developed world now, no nation is actually averaging 2.1 births. In fact, some nations have dropped down to one birth on average, or even lower, like 0.8. So when you get to that situation, your population is in serious decline. And there are now predictions that China's population will actually halve by the end of the century. So why aren't we hearing about that? You know, there was an article in the BBC, actually, funnily enough, at the beginning of this year, where it talked about this shock plunge in human population. And it's actually, you know, it actually does go into a fair bit of detail. But it's ironic that they come out with stuff like that, but at the same time, you know, that seems to get buried. And then the official narrative of how climate change and global warming is driven by these masses of people, and it doesn't add up. You know, it's like the official narrative is so sort of full of holes that all you need to do is have a, you know, pick a little bit and the whole thing starts to unravel. So, you know, I'm beginning to think that you actually have to invert some of what they say. They maybe, you know, say one thing, but it actually means the complete opposite. So when they're talking about, oh, we've got global, you know, we've got population growth and we need to slow it down, what they're actually saying is that we've got population decline. And the problem is we're not having enough young, you know, new young people born, children being born. We've got an aging population. And what happens when you have a very unbalanced situation with a large aging population? You have it creates a lot of problems. And I, you know, just, it's kind of a terrible thought, but what's actually happened in the last 2 years is that there's been, well, some people have described it as an eldercide. So it's, you know, that, and we know that they're claiming that COVID affected, you know, the elderly and the people with comorbidities and so on. Well, we also know that they actually removed treatment for anybody with COVID, right? They basically essentially left people on their own for 2 weeks. That was the official recommendation by all the public health bodies was that we don't know how to treat this novel disease. It's, you know, it's a new one on us and we have no idea what to use, which frankly is obscene. I mean, there's no time in history where they wouldn't try something, you know, to treat a disease. And then subsequently smear and suppress and deliberately manipulate the studies of alternative methods of treatment that do seem to work, right? So they've done everything in their power to prevent anyone from treating this, whatever it is, thereby killing all the people that are most vulnerable to it, whose immune systems aren't able to just shake it off. So if you look at it with that lens, you know, and this pandemic narrative that there will be more pandemics, they seem to be seeding this narrative that we have to get used to this concept that there will be more pandemics. And because they've actually, like I said before, they redefined the definition of what pandemic is, that it, you know, there doesn't have to be large numbers of serious illness and death. It just has to be a disease that spreads across the globe. You know, they can produce this effect. They can declare at any time that there's a pandemic, and then they can, you know, withhold treatment or provide the wrong sort of treatment, toxic cocktails of treatments that actually end up killing people. And they're getting rid of that problem of the balance, you know, where the population is top heavy with lots of elderly. You know, each time this comes around, they're pruning it and pruning it. And it just made me wonder if this is in fact what they're trying to do without saying as much.
Well, no, I think you're right. It is a very important for, you know, the elites now. I mean, it always has been, really, to have different agendas publicly as to what's really going on. I was just looking at something the other day about the British Empire and how that started back in Elizabethan times with John Dee. And they realised that if they wanted to launch the British Empire on the world, that they would have to make sure they were never found out until it had happened. So they came out with all sorts of, you know, sort of cover stories, really, about specific individuals who were just, you know, sort of swashbuckling explorers, blah blah. So there was a whole cover story for the creation of that, so that the, you know, the Dutch, the Spanish, French empires didn't realize what was going on until the British, you know, done their major part of their conquering, built up their navy, that sort of thing. So I mean, this is certainly nothing really new about that. But look, I know you're you know, you did a lot of work on Mandarin, certainly at GCHQ, and you're quite familiar with China. We've seen this week a massive lockdown of the whole of Disney World in China due to one case. Now, this is not somebody with symptoms, it's just a positive test in China. Also, the Chinese government, quite worryingly, saying to all their citizens, you're going to have to stockpile food because there may be you know, so more of this coming, or we're not saying specifically. I mean, this is an incredible thing for a government to do, saying we're telling everybody, please do stockpile tinned food and dried food, but we're not telling you really why.
I didn't actually know they'd done that, but as I say, I'm beginning to think that sometimes you have to invert what they say. I'm not saying don't stockpile food. It's always good. I mean, I think it's always good to have a sort of buffer so that you have a few, maybe a 3 week supply of food and potable water and some cash at hand and so on. You know, that's just kind of common sense, really, best practice. So yeah, getting citizens to almost panic buy is kind of weird.
Well, I mean, what it says to me is that we've got, I mean, because it's interesting that she was originally going to, but then announced he wasn't going to the COP26 climate summit. I mean, I stand back from this stuff and I think to myself, well, maybe it's just simply that they don't think that the climate is such a big priority as world peace and the potential explosive powder keg we've got building up between Israel and Iran in the Middle East. And they're saying, really sending a message to the Western leaders up at Glasgow, saying, well, if you don't sign this Iran nuclear deal, which Trump pulled out of, if you don't get that back on the table and re-sign it, like Biden promised to do before the election, then there's really not much point in talking about the climate.
Yeah. Well, that's possible. And you know, and these climate talks and things, they are window dressing. They are, you know, the sort of eureka moment I had this morning, actually, about thinking that everything they say is inverted. It's quite possible that the world is actually facing it, or ultimately will face a cooling phase. So, I mean, we're going through, you know, that possibly the next 10 years will be the last gasp of an active solar phase where the sun is, you know, producing a lot of sunspots and is very active. And then, you know, this talk about the maunder minimum and going into the great maunder minimum, it's, you know, it's conceivable, it's quite possible that we're actually going to then transition. And, you know, the world has gone through many, many cycles of this peak and trough of hot and cold weather, and we're due for another trough. And so once again, their policies of this, you know, shutting down basically the production of energy, you know, to the point where even in developed nations or post-industrial nations, there may very well be blackouts and so on, is going to contribute to the dying off of the most elderly and vulnerable. You know, and China can't really afford, I mean, China may actually be also seriously considering the impact of having such a massively increasing elderly population versus, you know, a young and vibrant one. I mean, their one-child policy, when you look at Chinese society and you look at the, you know, the rapid contraction of fertility from, you know, on average, probably about 5 births to an enforced policy of one child per woman, it's a massive social experiment that they conducted on their own population, which will, you know, is having huge impacts on their society and will continue to. But yeah, the fuel poverty, we'll see. I mean, the fuel prices are shooting up. We'll see fuel poverty throughout, you know, Europe and the UK. And that isn't just a new issue, you know, throughout the whole Tory government and this whole 10 years or more of austerity, you know, we had plenty of headlines in the past of people saying they had to choose between food and fuel, right? And you know, in a nation like the UK, the fifth richest nations in the world, it's appalling, it's disgusting that people have to choose between those two.
I just wonder if you've got any comment about the resignation of Jeremy Farrar, because he's been a very important figure in Britain through this pandemic, chairing SAGE, And I think, well, I'm not sure if he's also chair of the Wellcome Trust, but he's a very powerful figure on both of these. And the Wellcome Trust is it started well before the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in the US, is a sort of model for the Gates Foundation here in the UK. In fact, their research headquarters used to be next door to my secondary school in Beckenham in Kent. And they were for very many years doing lots of research into genetics of various sorts. It's quite an amazing place. It's called Langley House, which is it's a not very lovely old building, but next to it they've got a gigantic water tower and also an enormous chimney. That's what they used to have when I was there anyway, which we always used to joke about that, so as we walked past the house on the way back from school or whatever, saying, well, there's the water tower is to wash away all the bits of hideous genetic whatever that they're creating in there, to wash it down the drain, and then the chimney is to cremate and burn any kind of horrific creatures that they create. But that's our more, you know, gruesome sense of humour. But the Wellcome Trust is very, very important. They've got a massive, massive, massive budget. And again, like the Gates Foundation, they dish it out to whoever they will. For example, one of them is a woman called Professor Sharon Peacock, who failed her 11 plus but magically managed to persuade an administrator at Southampton University in a face-to-face meeting of some sort to give her the opportunity to do a five-year course to become a doctor, and now she's a professor. And her whole career really has been funded by the Wellcome Trust. And she's now in charge of Genomics UK, which is making all the policies and decisions around looking at new variants. So obviously this is quite an important part. But anyway, she's also her mentor, her hero, actually. She talks about in the BBC, the Life Scientific programme this week, she talks about Patrick Vallance, who's also, of course, somebody whose whole pretty much entire career has been funded by the pharmaceutical industry, not by public bodies. That's her hero. So, you know, these are the sorts of people who are making this policy. But anyway, so do you think it's good news that Jeremy Farrar has gone? And what is it, what I'm just saying about Professor Sharon Peacock, for example, tell you about how this policy is actually made?
Yeah, I hadn't clicked on that a link that where she talks to the BBC about it. But, you know, it there is so much corruption, so many conflicts of interest. The journalist, investigative journalist Whitney Webb, has written a couple of in-depth articles and reports on the Wellcome Trust. Her web blog is called Unlimited Hangout. So if anybody wants to find out more about Wellcome Trust and their various actions, and you know, you can go there and search for Wellcome Trust. One article, is the most recent one, was published in June of this year, is entitled A Leap Towards Humanity's Destruction: How the Wellcome Trust has teamed up with a pair of former DARPA directors who built Silicon Valley's Skunk Works to usher in an age of nightmarish surveillance. And then the previous article was published at the end of last year, December 2020, where she talks about how the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine have undisclosed ties to the renamed British Eugenics Society, as well as other eugenics-linked institutions like the Wellcome Trust. So, yes, it's a murky, grey world.
Yeah, I mean, I look upon it just as private companies really setting policy. And, you know, I say a private company, it's a trust, but they're certainly, you know, they are funded through the pharmaceutical companies. That's where most of their money comes from. and their various projects that they then sell on, even though it's supposed to be a kind of charity, basically. But what we seem to be seeing is this sort of rule by charities, where many of these people are on revolving doors, and they're now sitting in Sage, NerveTag, in these Genomics UK, these organisations which should be public bodies. It's almost as if it's gone along with the privatisation of so much, many of our universities too, that really what we're looking at here is a kind of corporatism, where actually it's these private organisations that have seem to have all the money. The government's strapped for cash, particularly after 2008, and the same sort of thing seems to be happening. It's almost like a privatisation of everything. I'm concerned that this is starting to move towards a world where we are simply owned and managed rather than really have any say whatsoever. So it doesn't matter who we elect, these people are still setting the policy and nobody has elected them at all.
Yeah. Well, Ian Davies, who has a blog called In-This-Together, has recently come out with a book about the pseudo-pandemic, he calls it, and the outcomes and the results and what it's all been about, really. And he calls this whole situation, he calls it the global public-private partnership. I think that describes it quite well. At one point we were just consumers, all of us, right? The great public we were pretty much put into the category of consumer. Now we will become commodities as well as consumers. And I think that's what a lot of people don't yet grasp, in particular what the left are failing to grasp, is that we are not just consumers anymore. We are now being turned into commodities, along with everything else on the planet. So the sooner the left get to grips with this and start challenging this, global public-private partnership, the better. Because they, as my friend pointed out in a talk yesterday, they have the tools, the left have the tools to deal with this. You know, they have the concept, the understanding, the insights into corporatizations of the public sphere. So they need, and I think the union, we need to really, people who are involved in unions to really, dig into union funding and influences on unions, because, they've been absolutely abysmal. In fact, they've been one of the principal drivers behind a lot of the COVID lockdown and masking and vaccination policies. So it's, I find that extremely disturbing and confusing, really, why unions have taken that stance.
Traditionally, big corporations have always wanted to control unions. They've spent quite a lot of time and effort infiltrating them. For example, when I say that, the government, it's quite well known, isn't it? During the miners' strikes of the 1970s and 1980s, the security services were all over these unions, making sure that, every action, everything that was going on was being tracked and followed and countered almost before it had even started. So, the unions have always been a target for that sort of thing. But look, you're talking about a partnership. I mean, my research that I've done on the links between the deals between the Nazis and the Allies at the end of the Second World War really points more towards a kind of Fourth Reich, which is a financial empire that was created by Hitler's secretary Martin Bormann over in South America after the war, with 750 companies, which much of the Nazi loot was laundered into through Sullivan and Cromwell's law firm in New York, which was the Dulles Brothers law firm. And those businesses ended up basically having former SS people, etc., on the boards, and even you know, Jewish people on the boards and sometimes a Jewish chairman, the idea being to disguise the fact that it was Nazi money in charge of the company. But I mean, that does seem to, you know, we also hear about this fourth industrial revolution, don't we? This is supposed to be what's happening. But I wonder what beneath that is actually a fourth Reich.
Yeah, there's, yeah, all sorts of layers. I mean, I think with the public-private partnership is that the public part is the weakest partner, you know, without the financial resources. So everything basically is, you know, dependent on financial resources. You know, in order to get anything done, you need upfront funding. And that's where, you know, that's where the compromise happened. We saw recently in the tweet, in the Twitter sphere this week, where David Beasley of the World Food Programme tweeted Elon Musk, didn't he, and said something like 2% of your income, which would be $6 billion, would solve world hunger. So it's this is where, you know, the strange situation where you have the heads of public organizations basically, I mean, some would say it was a challenge, but, you know, cap in hand, more or less, to the uber rich, the absolute, you know, unthinkable rich people of this world to donate just 2% of their income. And yet all this money, as we keep saying, all these vast sums, eye-watering amounts of money keep going into these so-called projects. And we all know that only a fraction, if any of it, actually filters down to the people that really need it. And the World Food Programme, you know, okay, they keep sustaining a large number of people who are destitute and have literally nothing to eat every day and can't even survive on subsistence level, you know, farming or anything. But, you know, the problem is never solved. I mean, there was the great famine in Ethiopia and, you know, all these various situations that, when you look back, a lot of them were man-made and they were preventable. And in fact, they were maybe deliberate, potentially, but they were certainly quite possibly preventable. And throwing massive sums of money at them, you know, hasn't actually solved the problem. So I think that's another topic, another day. But, you know, it's, as you say, perhaps the Fourth Reich.
Okay, Catherine. All right, that's brilliant. Thank you. Sorry to chuck that at you at the end there. But, you know, it's just, to me, it's like the elephant in the room is something, you know, something actually, there's a whiff of fascism around, really, that is.
And there's more than a whiff.
Know, yeah. And the, you know, it's, yeah, definitely. It's, yeah, if we get into things like transhumanism as well, it's got a massive kind of ideology all of its own, which seems to be, you know, also being kept quite quiet, you know, the idea that actually this is the way certain people, once you get to a certain degree of wealth, you know, a door becomes open to you, you know, are you going to come in here with us, you know, which is, and this is what we think, that actually we are gods and we can just alter the human genome. We can start fiddling with nature, commodify nature. We, since we're so rich, we now own it. We can now start actually improving humanity and coming up with propositions such as, well, if you pay X amount of money, you know, your children will live forever because we'll alter the genes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, frankly, I think that's complete fanciful nonsense. I mean, it's possible. It's possible they have some technology that is so advanced that, you know, and is hidden actually, that nobody is aware of it. But anything that is currently out in the open suggests that they don't really know what they're doing. I mean, they can cryogenically freeze all kinds of things. They can grow random stuff. They can clone things. But I don't think they understand, and I think that may come get to the heart of the problem, possibly, the mysteries of life and the fact that they don't really understand how the body actually works. They don't really understand how the immune system works. They don't really understand, you know, how life begins. Where does it come from? What is the first spark of life? They can't describe it. They can't explain it. They don't understand it. And it's this fundamental difference between those who live by the maxim, which is the fundamental foundation of all major world religions, you know, that do unto others as you would have done to you, you know, the vast majority of people who live by that maxim, and those who have decided to embrace the satanic alternative, which is do what thou wilt. And, you know, I don't know how successful it is to convert somebody from the one to the other, whether that's possible. I suspect it probably is, and that's what probably they're attempting to do now, is to convert people from the godly one to the ungodly one. And then it's possible that there are people who basically are born, and this would be the types of characters who are basically born psychopathic, and their maxim basically is naturally from within themselves, do what thou wilt and not consider the emotions of others.